Episode 26 of the Improvised Music Agenda. Welcome back. Who you hear back there is our guest this week, Ollie Bryce. Let's have a listen. Thank you for tuning in again to the Improvised Music Agenda. And if you're new, welcome. I am your host, Hugh V. Williams. Aside from doing this podcast, I am a musician. I play double bass and bass guitar and, yeah, compose a bunch of music as well as all that noise making that goes with this type of music. So, our guest this week is Ollie Bryce, as you heard up top. And, yeah, I'm really excited about this one. Because when I first started the podcast, I sort of made a list of who I'd want to have on it. And Ollie was very high on that list. And yeah, it's great. So I'm glad we finally managed to make it happen. Because it's quite hard sometimes. Because I always do these interviews in person. So, you know, because I live just north of London. And Ollie now lives in Hastings. So that's kind of by the coast. Down south. So, yeah, we managed to meet up. I think it was in early March 2019. Yeah, he happened to be around town and I happened to be going through town. And yeah, so we met up at the Oxford Tavern, which, yeah, if you remember the episode of the George Crowley or want to listen back to it, we mentioned that because George used to run a gig there. But yeah, we thought that was a good location to do it. And yeah, so we did it in the pub, so it might be a bit noisy in the background. I'll just warn you now. But yeah, we covered a whole load of topics. And yeah, very interesting person Ollie is. But anyway, before we carry on with the conversation, I've just spruced up the Patreon page for the podcast. So if you're enjoying the podcast, do go over there. Sling a few quid, and yeah, there's a video there of me begging for money and all sorts. So yeah, and if you can't do that, obviously you feel free to give a nice review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts, or feel free to share. And if you're enjoying it and want more people to listen, that's great. Anyway, so Ollie Bryce. Yeah, so Ollie, I don't know if I mentioned up top actually, he is a double bass player. And improviser, so he works a lot in the free improv world, plays a lot of free jazz as well, and as well as jazz. So I think so he's got links with a lot of the people I've interviewed as well recently. So the first episode with Dee Byrne, he plays in Dee's band Entropy, so you might have heard him in passing on that recording. But yeah, but Ollie's played with a load of heavyweight musicians, British guys, European guys, American guys. And yeah, he makes great music. And when I first moved down, I saw him play a lot. Yeah, because we sort of ran sort of in the same circles almost, or within the on the jazz side anyway. So yeah, I think it's a good one today, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Anyway, less of me blabbering. Here's Ollie Bryce. So, how was the commute from Hastings today?
It's good, straightforward, it's about an hour and a half into town. Not too bad.
Good. And then, so I guess you've been there for how many, 2 years now or so?
Yeah, 2.5 years.
Cool. And would you say that's kind of made the quality of the things, all the gigs that you're doing now, been a bit more selective with, or whether you think it's a bit easier?
The aim is definitely that anything I would have done when I lived in London, I still do. It's just a longer schlep to get here. So I'm not turning anything down for like the size of the fee or...
Right, yeah.
I probably have used it as an excuse for one or two things I wasn't that into. Yeah. But basically, hopefully none of those people are listening. But basically, no, I'm like a London musician who doesn't live in London.
Cool, yeah, yeah.
So
but I think it's the same
still
thing
back
here.
And forth all the time. How far out are you?
Where am I? So St Albans, so that's kind of Well, how long is it? Like 45-minute drive here, maybe.
Yeah.
So it's just outside the M25.
Close, north, but so. Yeah. Basically, it's hard to know sometimes. You don't know what would have happened in different circumstances, but I don't think it's made a big difference.
No,
yeah. If anyone is listening, I'm wondering whether they can book me. The answer is definitely yes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because I was reading an interview the other day with you know, the bass player Adam Hopkins, Brooklyn guy. But was it? Because I think you mentioned he just moved to Richmond, Virginia, or something.
Right.
But you made it clear in the interview saying, like, yeah, I'm still up for these projects. But then I just looked on Google Maps, like, how long the drive was. It's like 8-hour drive. I was like, yes, this dude's committed.
Yes, it's a different scale over there, isn't it? Local gigs are like within a 10-hour radius.
Yeah, exactly. It's fairly bad. But I guess
thing, I've done gigs in East London where I've left home after the bandmates who lived in West London.
Yeah.
You know, it takes so long to get around London anyway.
Totally.
And get home in less than 2 hours from the Vortex.
Yeah.
So it's not so different.
Definitely, yeah. But, and then I guess there's a bit of a scene in Hastings, isn't there? Because was it Terry?
There's a few musicians. Trevor Watts is just around the corner from me. I've been doing a bit of duo stuff with him. It's been amazing. Jason Yard is also fantastic. He's down there. Done a couple of things with him and got more planned. There's a good, fairly straight ahead jazz club, right? But they did put on my quintet, which was definitely pushing their boundaries a bit, but
yeah,
well received, good turn. That was fun, and I've played there more than I guessed I would, to be honest.
Oh, that's cool.
Never really imagined I'd do a lot down there, but I have, and I've got involved in slightly different things. Like I played at a poetry festival and worked with a Japanese buto dancer.
Great.
And interesting different spin on things. It's a great place to be. I really like it a lot.
Yeah, and that seems a cool vibe. It's like, because we never hear about the community there. All the arts thing is just like, yeah, a lot of creatives around.
Yeah, it's really arty, but also it's still basically a working class town. It's cheap, it's friendly, and it's not like, you know, it's not like living in, from what it's called, on the Kent coast. It's like really twee and arty. It's like much more sort of down to earth. But there are lots of artists there. I can get out in the hills really easily, walk along the cliff tops, and yeah, it's great. I love it.
Yeah. Oh, great. So, So if we kind of go right to the beginning now. Did you grow up in London originally?
Originally, yeah. Yeah, in Clapton. So.
Oh, okay.
All the gigs are still in my home territory, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Early child, but until I was 12, I lived in London.
Oh, great. And then, so did you move around?
Yeah, I lived in Jerusalem for my teenage years. I don't normally talk about that too much. I don't want to...
Oh, right, sure. Yeah.
But I'm happy to answer questions. But I don't see myself as an Israeli jazz musician. But
no,
I lived
no.
there for... I was 19.
Okay.
7 years. Went to university in Manchester. A couple of years in Bath, which is where I started being a gig musician, kind of overlapping the Bristol scene, and then back to London until recently.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, all right. So was it when you went to Manchester that you got into music?
I started playing the bass in Manchester. I'd played guitar before then, and I just started gigging in Manchester, but not a lot, the first handful of things. Bath was really where I gave up my day job and started practicing all day and
taking
it more seriously.
Yeah, so, no, because I've read like a bunch of interviews that you've done, but what I find interesting, because you're saying playing guitar kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then you always had the dream of playing
the
bass.
Yeah, it was definitely a dream, but I didn't think it was a very realistic dream. And I didn't really... I was kind of not that serious a guitarist, and I couldn't really work out what the guitar would do in the music I was into. And I just thought, you know, I was 22, I think, when I started playing the bass. It seemed a bit late to take up a serious instrument, and they're expensive, and I was living in a squat, I didn't know where to put it, and it was like, is this really going to work? But I got together with my partner, who I'm still with, and we were sort of talking about, what do you want to do with your life? And I was saying, that's really what I want to do, but probably too late. It's like, well, fuck it, do it.
Yeah,
if that's all you want to do, then do it.
Definitely.
I haven't got one there and then, pretty much.
Oh, great.
So I almost immediately became a full-time musician from taking up the bass. Within a year, I'd given up my job.
I mean, yeah, there's loads of those jokes. Like, yeah, isn't there loads of joke about kind of...
a bass player, or was it someone getting bass lessons?
Yeah.
Like the first week they learned the E string, second week they learned the A string.
Third week they don't show up.
Yeah, because they've got a gig. Yeah,
exactly. So I did kind of do that. I guess in London that's not the case, but everywhere else it's still the case. And it means you get to play with good players way before you're at that level, which is such a great way of getting better.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. Like, yeah, I've definitely been in those situations where it's kind of like, oh yeah, I'm blessed that I picked this instrument.
Yeah, totally.
Because I'm getting my ass kicked.
Absolutely. And within a few months of starting, I was playing this band that was mostly just a rehearsal band, a few gigs, but it was a weekly bebop session, just playing Charlie Parker tunes, basically, but with all guys who were 20 years older than me, and like only one of them was a professional musician, but they were all fairly serious amateurs who'd been working at it for decades, and they like, you just have to sort of work like mad to try and keep up to some degree.
Yeah.
And learn as you do it.
Yeah.
Best way, really.
Definitely. It's like, what's the phrase for that? Trial by fight? No.
Yeah.
Kind of. Oh, I've forgotten that. Brain's gone. But yeah, so, all right. So, like, with the stuff you were listening to before picking the bass up.
Yeah.
So, were you into the whole free jazz things?
Massively, yeah. From an early age, I got into sort of classic 60s free jazz from when I was maybe 14 or something like that. Hugely into Ornette and Albert Eiler and Coltrane, Cecil, Archie Shepp, that kind of thing. And that was the music not that long after, also got into more sort of European improv and Evan and Derek Bailey and Brotson and stuff. But I was a really massive fan long before I was at all serious about playing it, records and going to gigs as much as possible. And I used to order records from Derek Bailey to Jerusalem.
Oh, wow.
This is pre-internet and whatever. You couldn't buy that stuff in Israel. So I used to do it by fax, and for years I kept to these faxes in his handwriting.
Amazing.
That sort of teenage way. And yeah, posting Incas records out. And there was an amazing secondhand, what was it called? It's a guitarist called Stefan Javorzin. I can't remember the name of his catalogue, but he basically sold secondhand free jazz vinyl and improv vinyl through the post for a catalogue. So he'd post your catalogue every month. And
wow.
I was like, you know, saving up my pocket money, buying obscure free jazz records.
Amazing, yeah. And then, because was it with the Incas thing? I came across a track, I don't know, maybe a few years ago, but there's like just Derek Bailey playing, but talking over.
Yeah, is that the one in New York? Oh, there's a few we did that.
Possibly, but he's just like giving his address away, just like, buy the records from me. It's like,
it's brilliant. Yeah, I remember my dad was over in London, I think, for work, and he had to go to Derek Bailey's house and collect these records I'd bought.
Amazing. Because where was that house? Was that?
Sort of Hackney Downs kind of area,
just off
the park. So ironically, if I'd stayed where I'd grown up, it would have been a short walk from my house.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So Derek Bailey was in Hackney Downs before he got hip then?
Yes, just off Amherst Road, I think. I never actually went to his house, but I think that's right.
All right, but then... Yeah, because when did he pass away? 2005, wasn't
it? Sounds right, yeah. I don't know exactly.
Because I was just thinking, if he ever hung out Vortex and stuff, he must have done. Or was it Vortex in Stoke Newington then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he used to play there a lot.
But, but it's funny, just imagine kind of who's still about. Otto, you know, be there all the time.
Absolutely.
Ugh. Anyway, sorry. I'm fantasizing it. But, cool. All right, so that's amazing you got those records shipped. Then, so were there people coming over to play when you were introduced?
A bit, not a huge amount, but I got to see some stuff. I remember seeing Dave Douglas came over. There was a bit of a local scene there. There's a saxophonist called Stephen Hornstein who's on some Bill Dixon records in the 70s. Basically, there's a few Americans who got religion and moved there. And
right.
Then there's doing tiny, tiny little gigs in Jerusalem because there wasn't really much of a scene for that music, but... Bits and pieces.
Oh, okay.
And we came back to England about once a year or so, staying with family. And my relatives in Hackney still, so then I could see gigs then, going to little improv gigs in rooms above pubs and stuff. And my uncle's an improv musician and had amazing record collections.
So oh, really?
That's what turned me on to it already.
Oh, man, I know. Who's your...
Ivor Callan?
Sorry?
Ivor Callan.
No.
Just arrange yourself on Resonance and plays an intro barrel with Hannah Marshall and Alison Blunt.
Oh, wow, okay.
He's great. And he was, yeah, he was the one who... Like when I'd heard about it, I guess you're being into weird rock stuff.
Okay.
And I've had some notion, I think Ivor plays weird music, he might know who this Albert Isla is. So I asked him, and his face lit up, and like, amazing. Come with me. And then every time we'd go and stay in the house most summers, and there'd always be a box of tapes waiting for me.
Amazing.
He'd recorded, so, you know, it's an album on each side, a 90-minute cassette.
Oh, right. Oh, man, that was amazing. Get the encouraging...
Yeah, fantastic.
Thing. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. And then... But yeah, so like when you picked up the guitar, was that trying to play in that kind of style, or were you into the whole rock thing?
Yeah, I mean,
as well?
I got into different things. I was very into sort of early acoustic blues for a while and trying to play like that. Not that I was any good at it, but definitely trying. And wanting to play improv, but not really knowing anyone, like saying not having any peers who are interested in that music. A bit of trying to play jazz, but not very seriously, definitely not very successfully at that point. And yeah, like any teenager playing in rock bands and punk bands and stuff too, but the sort of definitely noisy weird stuff attracted me straight away. That was all. And in a way, some of the more experimental rock, like when the whole post-rock thing happened and that kind of thing, rather than that being a gateway into improv, for me it was almost like, oh, here's some music that my peers might like that I can even get into too. Somewhere between the weird stuff I was listening to and stuff other people might listen to.
Right,
so
yeah.
So I sort of came back into rock a bit through that.
All right, cool. Yeah, but did you ever check out Mr. Bungle and those kind of things?
I'm aware vaguely of them. Right, yeah. That was never...
No, because that's...
There's always much more punk than metal.
All right, okay,
I was into. So more like Sonic Youth and...
Right, yeah,
that
yeah.
That kind of scene, Minutemen, Fugazi.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, man, there's a lot of that music I need to check out. Because it's funny, like, checking out Thurston Moore, because I probably know more of his kind of thing being an improviser than Sonic Youth, and going back towards all that, and it's like, oh, yeah, God, there's all these, like, amazing albums.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can't say it's stuff I've listened to in a long time, to be honest, but, yeah, he comes, you see him at gigs and stuff like that. I did have thought, like, oh, I wish I could go and tell my 16-year-old self that Thurston Moore would be in the audience one of my gigs.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have been very chuffed at that point.
Amazing. Definitely. So, cool. So when you were playing around Manchester then, so were you going to improvise with a bunch of guys? Or was it like mainly jazz?
No, I was starting to. There's a great drummer who was kind of the centre of the Northwest improv scene then, is in Portugal now, Philip Marks, who I used to go first, like, just going to listen to him a lot, and I used to put on gigs as well, so booking him stuff. And then when I started playing the bass, started playing with him, that was that amazing, like we were just talking about, of playing with a really serious heavy improviser regularly before I knew what I was doing. Like, yeah, amazing experience. And also, do you know Dave Birchall, guitarist in Manchester?
Oh, another name. Yeah.
We were old mates and used to live together and at college together, so I played in bands with him that was initially like kind of instrumental post rock Mogwai influence sort of thing, and then got more and more improvised with time. So I was playing with him and starting to play jazz, but I sort of, through wanting to play free stuff, I realised that I needed to learn how to play jazz to play free the way I wanted to play it. So then started delving back into it. So that was really, I definitely wasn't a good gigging jazz bass player in Manchester. That was definitely later that I got more of that stuff together. But
all right, yeah. And then, all right, so like, how long were you in Manchester? Was that for...
5 years, maybe.
Okay.
University, and then a couple of years more.
Yeah, because what did you study?
History and sociology.
All right, cool. Great. And then, cool, yeah, so that must be... Well, yeah, I guess that's cool. That relates to music as well, you know, the history of
definitely.
Scenes, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I should also mention I started studying then with Steve Berry.
Fantastic
bass player. He was really just right for me, like really inspiring teacher and really unjudgmental and encourage you to do your own thing. And
so
it was, yeah, really cool.
Great. And then, so you moved to Bath?
Yeah,
after
just
that.
That's where my partner was from, and she wanted to go to university, and sort of made sense, and we were just there for a couple of years. But that was when I wasn't working, just playing bass all the time. And also I met Nick Malcolm, who you must know, which... So that was like, yeah, having a P peer who was excited about a lot of the same stuff, and we just played together all the time because he was living there then as well.
Oh, great, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, because I guess there's a lot of people around that kind of Bristol, Bath area.
Yeah, I think it's a much better scene now than it was then, to be honest. I think, like a lot of places, London rents meant more people have either stayed or moved back. But there was some, Jake McMurtry was around, Kevin Fidges, there were some good players and places to play. You could make some money, like there were parties to do, and even without being that great, there was sort of work to be had.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
And
yeah,
some listening gigs. Bebop Club was going, still is.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, I've not spent too much time in Bristol. Like, yeah, maybe play there once or so.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But I guess, yeah, because the commute between Bath and Bristol is
really
not
close,
too
yeah,
big,
there's
is
kind
it,
of
yeah,
the same scene, really.
Yeah. And then, oh, cool. Yeah, so, like, in terms of the activity that was happening there, so it's mainly playing with Nick Malcolm.
Yeah.
Was that the...
And just becoming a working musician, I was playing in Gypsy Jazz Band, up and down the canal, and a lot of accompanying singers, and it was the first time when I felt like I'm actually a musician rather than a hobbyist. So I was doing practicing all day and making a living playing
great
pubs and restaurants, and the Bebop Club was probably the first sort of listening gigs where audience members actually came to hear a gig that I started doing in Bristol.
All right, yeah.
That was definitely the beginning of that.
Yeah, and like with those projects, like with the first like listening type gigs you were doing. So were we leading things?
Yeah, I'd started that then. I had a quartet, mostly Penguin at Coleman tunes then, with Nick and Jake McMurtry and different drummers.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've been playing, just planning a new project with Nick now, so we've been playing together pretty steadily.
Oh, wicked. Ever so since. What was that band with Nick? Or is it too early to... give details.
It might be actually.
Okay, cool. We'll move on to the next bit. But cool. So that sounds cool. So then you moved to London after that.
Yeah.
So you're saying 2 years in Bath. So what was the decision to come to London?
Mostly music. Bath was a brilliant place to learn a bit of craft, but I just really wanted to throw myself into creative playing, free playing, and I was really excited by. There was a website at the time called Ear Connector that Alex Bonney was running. It was recording live gigs, a lot of them in the pub we're sitting in right now, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I think I've seen that website, yeah.
And the others in St. Newington was another big place that time, the Con. And I was just really excited by a lot of that music. I wanted to play with those people, and like people who were serious about free stuff and tunes and throwing it all in. And, yeah, I thought it was a really exciting thing I wanted to be involved in. So that was definitely the main impetus for moving.
And then, all right, so did you have any connections with people on the scene here before moving? Or
very few. Yeah, not a lot at all. I'd met Alex Ward. I think we played together in Manchester briefly. And Roger Turner I'd put on in Manchester with Lil Coxill. So I knew a handful of people, but I just basically threw myself into it. There were a lot of gigs at that point. So it was quite easy to find people, and I was living in Hackney, and that was the centre of all those gigs. There was a really big one for me. There was a weekly gig that Ingrid Laubert used to run at the Others in St. Newington. Yeah, that room above the pool hall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was a gig followed by a jam session, and with the idea that the jam session would be kind of in keeping with the gigs, either improv or original stuff and not sort of a standards jam. And a lot of the people I ended up playing with, I met there. Mark Hamslip, Alex Bonney, Ingrid. Yeah, it was like the centre of what I wanted to be doing.
Oh, great, yeah. Because, forget that Ingrid Laubrock was in London.
Yeah, yeah, for years. She was here for about 10 years, I think, or maybe even more than that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, amazing. And then, yeah, so what sort of bands were playing there that time?
Outhouse.
Oh, wow.
Was going, yeah. Which was great. Ingrid, at the time, she was already with Tom Rainey, but living here. So whenever he had gigs in London or near London, he'd be coming and staying with her. So he was playing there quite a lot. And so I've seen him do like three trios of her and John Edwards, or tunes with Larry Bartley and Ingrid.
Wow.
That was really cool. Seb Rochford's various things, we would do that. Trying to remember the name of bands. It was basically, it was kind of Loop Collective, Fire Collective type.
Oh,
scene.
Right, okay. Yeah, wow. So that was like, was that pre-Loop Collective, maybe?
No, it was definitely, yeah, definitely was a Loop Collective sort of associated thing. So yeah. I think the night here, the Oxford, was the actual loop night, but
yeah,
it's the same scene.
Definitely, yeah. But it's amazing. I love hearing the history of everything, because I guess, yeah, let's say similar thing, like, to you, I guess. Like, I was checking out all these things.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, God, there's all these hip things in London, you know, the Con, like, the Oxford, and...
Yeah, definitely.
I remember
yeah,
even, like, getting the Megabus from Cardiff when we were in college to go and see stuff at the Con.
Oh,
like,
brilliant.
Yeah.
You had that mythical fly gig at the Con.
No, I think that was... When was that? Was that 2000
something? I'm terrible at years. I don't know. I'd not long been in London. I think that was the first time I went to the Con.
Oh, wow.
And it was, like, probably three times the fire regulation limit of people that rammed into that basement. And I think I could have leant out and plucked the Larry Grinder's bass strings.
Amazing.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, that was pretty intense.
Yeah, because... where was I? When did we start coming down? Because I was hanging out, you know, like Lloyd Haynes,
yeah.
Joe Webb and stuff, and Alex Haynes. But what was one of the first gigs I remember seeing? I think it was just before Richard Turner passed away.
Right.
Like, we started popping down to see things.
Yeah, so like, this is probably a couple of years before that I'm thinking of.
But it's mad, but it's just seeing the pictures of that.
Yeah, Richard, it's amazing.
With, like, Larry and Mark Turner, it's like, wow, God, this dude's, like, nailed it.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
A very cool vibe. The same... The thing of the others was just seeing really great music every week in a really accessible way. And also going to, like, some point, Evan Parker had his trio then with John Edwards and Tony Marsh, and every month at the Vortex. I just used to go every month, basically, without fail, for about 3 years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man, that must have been great living in Hackney at that time.
Yeah, just it was very
distance
cool.
Ever, I guess.
Exactly,
nearly,
yeah.
But, cool. Yeah. So... Yeah, so like the various musical activities you were up to after moving down.
Yeah.
So I guess you like got on with it quite quick, playing with people.
Pretty quick. I had a couple of happy meetings. Met Mark Hanslip at that Outhouse gig, and we started playing together in a trio with Tony Marsh. I don't know if you
know. Wow.
Yeah. Tony, who was amazing. And that was a real privilege, because Tony must have already been into his 70s, I'm pretty sure, when we started playing with him. And it's a trio called Tom Mix. We did quite a bit of gigging and touring. And he just had an amazing amount of time and patience for, you know, we'd rehearse and we'd listen back to gigs together and he'd talk about how it felt.
Wow.
Yeah, really amazing. So that was a real privilege to really feel like it was a band in that sense of developing, but with someone who'd been involved in music for so long.
Yeah.
And also through him I met... Like, ended up playing Paul Dunmore, Evan Parker, Neil Metcalf,
wow.
Ray Worley, all these people I've been listening to for years.
Yeah.
And Tony was a big part of finding that. I definitely felt like apprenticing to Tony, I would say. He's a challenging character in a lot of ways, but incredibly generous and warm, really special bloke. So that trio was one of the first things I did. And also, there's a wonderful drummer, Javier Carmona, who's moved back to Spain now.
Yeah, I kept seeing the name a lot.
Yeah,
I think he must have moved back before I moved here,
probably.
Maybe.
And he's pretty much my age and lived not far away. And we just used to play together all the time in his house and with different people. And we had played together with Ingrid Laubrook, which also led to that being a band that made one of my first records and tours and, you know, toured Spain and stuff. So those are probably the two things that really started to feel like meaningful things that generated a bit of momentum. And
yeah.
And people knew who you were.
Definitely, yeah. Then, did you ever record that trio with Tony Marsh and Hanslip?
Nothing ever got released. There's quite a lot of live recordings.
Okay. Cool.
Mark's quite a perfectionist. And
nothing
ever quite came together one way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that sounds cool though. That sounds like it's been nice listening back.
It's amazing, and it's an interesting thing. I did listen back to something not that long ago, and in a way, thinking like, yeah, it's so early in my development, and listening to it, and thinking, God, I really couldn't play, and so. But you could totally hear that I sound like me, basically, just me without lots of the things I've learnt since.
Right. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
really nice to hear that a lot of what I'm trying to do as an improviser is there. I mean, that band in particular was really influential in just working out what I wanted to do and how to go about doing it. And just learning, I mean, Tony was so powerful a drummer, so much energy. He'd almost always play sets right through, and he'd sort of, when me and Mark started to flag and running out of steam a bit, it'd get louder and faster.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, how did shit draw on reserves, didn't know you had bleeding on the base and stuff.
Amazing.
And just, yeah, again, like we said before, what did you say, trial by fire or something? It's like, yeah. You got to do it. If you're playing with a Paul Dunmore or someone, just got to keep up until hopefully you get to a point where you can actually contribute something meaningful to the discussion. But
yeah.
There's a fair bit of just sort of hanging on for dear life.
Amazing.
On the way there.
But yeah, it's the best experience, isn't it?
Totally, kind of, yeah.
But cool. So yeah, but like all that kind of activity sounds cool. Then, so like, so you were starting a quartet with Handslip, was it originally? Because that first record, the quintet record you bought out. So when was that released? That was 2013 or 14, was it?
Could be. I never know what year anything was.
Yeah.
I have to think what year it is now. Yeah. It'd be about then.
Yeah, because I remember seeing you guys. Actually, it was playing here in the Oxford.
Right, yes, I remember meeting you, actually.
Yeah, was it that gig, like, your E string snapped?
Yeah.
And they were like, come back to Trial of by Fire thing. It's like, oh, fuck it, I'll play.
Oh, wow, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, well, that band, it took a while of trying different people to found the right lineup. But Jeff getting to it was another one of those amazing things. I just was such a fan of his playing.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually know him. I'd never spoken to him. But I was writing these tunes, I guess trying to reconcile the stuff I was into as a free player with also love of jazz and melody and that aspect of things. And everything I imagined involved him playing them, basically. So I sort of got the courage to email him, and he was really up for it and sweet about it. And then immediately felt amazing. From beginning to play with him, just felt so comfortable. And consistently found that you think it's so scary to play with people who are amazing, you look up to, but actually it's easier to play with better musicians.
No, definitely, man.
They understand what's out there, hear of a thing and make it better.
Totally.
And that was definitely an example of that. I was like, yeah, this is perfect. So him agreeing to join was definitely what made it take that. Then it's going to work. And Mark was always going to be the Turner player, and Alex Bonney, again, had a really close relationship with him since moving to London and been in each other's bands and worked together all the time. And the record actually has a sort of a guest on it, Vaslav Zimpel, amazing alto clarinet player from Poland, who I think only ever did one gig with the band.
Yeah, did he? Because I think I saw that gig as well, maybe. Was that
was
the Con?
At the Con. That was the day before we recorded the album, or 2 days before recording the album.
Wow, yeah.
But I'd played with him because I'd started going to Poland by that stage, playing a Polish saxophonist, Mikhail Czaszka, and Mark Sanders in a trio. And so I'd met Vaslav out there and just loved his playing. And because a big part of my writing does draw on kind of Jewish stuff from my childhood, and I wanted, though he's not Jewish, he has that kind of interest in Eastern European folk music and Jewish music, and he could bring that side of it. I don't think anybody else in the band knew in the same way.
Yeah.
And the clarinet being associated with that music could just brought that out more.
Definitely. But like, so just thinking about the whole bringing that heritage into the music, like what sort of qualities did you kind of, or was it kind of like musical things in particular, like some like note choice or harmony, or was it kind of the historic thing, trying to portray that story?
It's more, I mean, there's an element of it being about notes, but it's more about emotion, I would say. I think, because I went to synagogue, as I was brought up a religious Jew, I went to synagogue a lot, and so it is a lot of my oldest musical memories of that kind of singing. And I was very conscious of not wanting to do a kind of Masada thing, like play klezmer jazz or anything like that, but wanting the sensation of how powerful it feels like when you've got a room of people singing together with that kind of conviction and emotional engagement and history behind it. So that, and I mean, there's definitely some of the writing comes from transcribing bits of actual liturgical music and then messing around with it, making it my own. But so there's definitely is a pitch and harmony influence, but more the emotional content is more influence.
That's what hits me with a lot of that kind of more traditional music, not that I'm checked out too much, but it's like but it's just that kind of yeah, the emotional thing, how that comes through is incredible.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to describe it. If it's like sadness in the music, or maybe not sadness, but kind of a collective.
Yeah, I mean,
kind of we're in it together kind of thing, we made it through.
It's not a fashionable word, but it's a spiritual thing, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's the same with Coltrane or whatever. It's that sort of just really giving yourself up to a bigger thing than what licks you've worked out or...
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Being carried, which is, I think it's the same thing that attracted me about a lot of free playing, is just the kind of really taking off into something beyond conscious decisions and being swept up in it, and
definitely
how engaging it is and how moving it is.
Yeah, no, I agree, man. Yeah, it's kind of, but I mean, that's yeah, like especially seeing people playing in person, seeing
yeah,
that and kind of how they're just like something taking. But like, yeah, sometimes you can tell the difference between someone saying like, "Oh, I'm trying a bit of free playing kind
yeah,
of thing.
Absolutely.
Maybe I should do this thing because it's a bit weird." But that is not real, I guess. But then
no.
We see people like really kind of.
Yeah, totally, and that yeah, I think that's the most powerful thing. You have to see it live. I remember one particular gig at the Vortex with Evan and Paul Dummel and Paul Rodgers and Tony Levin.
Wow.
By this stage, I was already a gigging. Like, it's not that early in my development, but. Just thinking like, wow, it can be that heavy.
You really
have to work harder and take it more seriously. That's a whole another level of just like, yeah, going to deeper, more powerful places than necessarily knew possible. So aspiring to that feeling, basically, I think is what I've always been chasing.
Totally, yeah. And then, cool. So with the quartet... Oh, it's now a quintet, isn't it? And then
mostly been a quintet. It's a quintet.
Oh, yeah, of course, because then, yeah. So, and then George Crowley's in it now.
Yeah,
I'm guessing,
Mark moved up to Manchester and George was depping, and then just some other than every time asking Mark, him saying no, asking George, it just made sense to swap it round. And George is great and brings a lot of the same qualities as Mark in a way, and that is... very serious and knowledgeable about the whole jazz tenor history, but also really flexible and open and creative and personal. So really easy fit to replace Mark. And Mike Fletcher is in it.
Brilliant.
He's now living in Spain, so not always available either.
Yeah. Wow. but that's cool. So you recorded that version of the band.
Yeah, we did a 10-date tour and then recorded a couple of days after the tour, so it all felt really together and fresh and
brilliant. And then George was telling me about the recording with that.
Oh yeah,
I think that might have influenced how I recorded this thing last summer with it.
Right.
But what did you say? Just play.
We gigged it a lot, so everyone knew the tunes, and just went and did it live and. Very quickly at the Fish Factory. Yeah, and I'm really pleased with that band. It really is what I want it to be. There's a lot of close relationships within it. I'm in Mike's trio with Jeff, and I'm in Alex's band with Jeff, and so all that. There's a lot of shared feeling about how to approach that kind of music.
Yeah,
stuff that's very free and jazz based, basically.
Amazing, yeah.
And Jeff's such a joy to play with, always.
Man, he's insane. Like, I've only played with him a couple of times, but yeah, it's like, but I just love it. Like the directions he takes. It's kind of because we were playing Alan Nathu's music,
right?
But like some of it, you know, like you could kind of go off on one a bit. They were just playing a form, then I just hear him kind of like edging towards this thing. It's like, cool, let's go there then. Great,
yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, him and Mark Saunders are definitely the two drummers I play with the most, and they're probably my two favourite drummers in the world, regardless whether I get to play with them. They're just...
Yeah,
couldn't be luckier. They're both amazing.
Definitely. Very much heavyweight.
Yeah.
Improviser. Timekeeper dudes.
Yeah, everything.
Definitely. Then, all right, so the latest things you've been up to. So, so you're playing with Mark Saunders again, with Tobias Delius.
I play with Mark in loads of different things. Close colleague, but we've got a trio called Somersaults with Toby Delius, which made a record a couple of years ago, and we've just recorded the second record, which I'm going to self-release in my first time putting something out myself.
Oh, great, yeah.
So see what happens with that, and we'll be touring in October. Right at the beginning of October, the second we start.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, just putting the finishing touches on that, but it's pretty much in place.
Oh, great. And then, oh man, yeah, self-releasing stuff.
Yeah.
It's all cool. How far into it are you deciding the artwork and stuff for?
My sister's going to do the artwork, who did the first album as well.
Oh, so brilliant.
She's done a lot of albums and one. I want to put it out in time for the tour, so probably bring it out in September. So still got to work out details of how and where to, like whether it's worth paying for glass mastering and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but, yeah, yeah.
But I've committed mentally to doing it now.
Good, good.
That's the big step, I think.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that, but maybe we'll do that off mic.
Sure.
The self-releasing thing, because no one else wants to do the business shit. Anyway, so cool. And then also other activity you've been up to. So I was mixing with Bonnie the other day, and he said you guys recorded your first solo thing.
Yeah, I don't know what's happened. That was very recent. It was just a few days ago. But I've been getting more and more into doing solo gigs, really enjoying that. It's gone from being terrifying to still quite scary, but exciting. And actually, I was just talking about Mark Sanders. I was gigging with him not that long ago, and he just out of the blue turned around to me and said, "It's time you made a solo record." I was like, oh, I'd kind of been thinking about it anyway. And Mark's given me good advice over the years. I thought, okay, then, I'll do what he says.
Good.
And did. I haven't really listened back yet, so I don't know.
All right.
Just very early days what's going to happen with that. But.
But in terms of like the whole playing solo thing, so I'm guessing you're coming at it from mostly improvised things.
Yeah, there's some little snippets of ideas or composed stuff. There's a little medley of Albert Isla tunes.
Oh, great.
And a couple of things of mine, but it's pretty much free.
Yeah, but just thinking about the creative process with that. So, for example, how long have you been performing solo?
I think the first one must be about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. But for quite a long time, I only did them in a short set and a bill of three bands or something like that, mostly not in London, quite low pressure, and quite spread out. Like I did one a year for a few years, and then I did one in Cafe Otto I think a year ago, pretty sure it was a year ago, that felt like a bit of a breakthrough, that I was more pleased with it than I'd been with any up to then. And also it's quite a big audience. It's opening for a project John Butcher was in. There's quite a lot of people there, and
wow.
It was quite scary, and felt like it had worked in context. So that gave me a bit of confidence to pursue it more. I've done a couple in Hastings, actually, partly because people say, "Oh, John, do a gig, there's no money. I'm not going to ask someone to come down from London for money."
Yeah.
I can do it easily enough. So the last year I've been doing more and feeling like it's something I wanted to pursue more.
Cool, yeah, because I haven't done much myself, but I think the longest I've played solo in front of an audience maybe 15 minutes continuous, but it's funny, like, because I find it quite hard in one sense, because what I'm used to, you know, kind of used to backing someone else up in a way, musically. But, I don't know. Did you feel like you had those things, or did you feel...
This maybe sounds really arrogant, but I'd sometimes started to feel on improv gigs, like when I got solo space, I wanted more space than I was getting. Like people were coming back in while I thought I was still just developing
an
idea. So that made me start thinking, actually, I do want to sort of stretch into that a bit more. And it is... I mean, the double bass is such a beautiful sound, and so much of it is easily lost.
Yeah.
So it is really tempting to be able to like enjoy what's gorgeous about it and let things ring out and have all that space. That only takes someone touching a cymbal, and we've lost loads of our dynamic range.
Definitely.
So I definitely enjoy having that, like being able to make small sounds really sing and explore stuff with space around it. And there's such an amazing history of, you know, freely improvised records, double bass records, and the Buff Phillips stuff, and Barry Guy, and Covell, and William Parker, and Joe Leondra. And most people in that world have done at least one. But I guess you have to put all that out of your mind when you come to trying to make your own. the weight of history is a bit scary as well.
Exactly, yeah, because what's come out recently? Larry Grenadier's done a solo.
Yeah, I've not heard that, and I consciously didn't want to listen to it before
making my
own. I had the same, and it's not even bass, but Alex Hawkins gave me his piano solo record, I think 2 days before my recording. I thought, I'm really looking forward to listening to this, but I'm going to leave it till I don't want to be thinking about other people's solutions to problems.
Yeah.
On the day, and I'm sure it's going to be great. I need to check that out, but I haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah, totally. But but what would be your solo bass album highlights?
It's a lot I love, but Bar Phillips definitely number one for me. And he was literally he was the first person to do that. His newest one is absolutely gorgeous. Have you heard it?
I've heard snippets online. Oh, it sounds beautiful. Incredible, but really it's just sound. It's like he gets the rumble of the bottom end. It's incredible.
Gorgeous, gorgeous album. And they're all, all of his solo stuff, I think he's made, off the top of my head, maybe five over his career, and they're all masterpieces.
Yeah.
Barry Guy solo as well, I really love. There's a fantastic one by Wilbert de Jurda. The name of the album's got my head. It's fairly hard to find on a little Dutch label, but that's a really great
example.
All right,
cool. Yeah, but tell you one of my favourites is, do you know Peter Herbert?
Yeah,
Austrian
yeah, that
bass
is
player.
A really good record.
But yeah, you know that, yeah.
I do.
I love that.
Is that Naked Bass? Is that the one?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
But you know, because I remember having a lesson with him, but I think he made a book. He transcribed everything he played. He gave me the book.
I remember seeing some of that in Double Bassist magazine many years ago.
Oh, dude, it's amazing. I'd
be interested to have a look at that book. Yeah, because he's got that classical background as well, hasn't he?
He does, and it's kind of, but yeah, it's amazing just like the little tricks he uses and kind of, I've kind of nicked
some
stuff.
Definitely, I think it's a really valuable process developing a solo vocabulary because it makes you think about what your vocabulary is.
Yeah,
I think it's really useful for that, if nothing else, even if you never end up releasing it or whatever. But doing it every now and again is a kind of checking in on. And what you would actually do with all that space is definitely good for your own development.
Okay.
It used to be compulsory in the AACM.
Did
it? As part of the charter. If you want to be a member, you have to do a solo gig a year minimum.
Amazing.
So I think it's great. I subscribe to that.
Yeah, but what was it? Because I just started reading, was that book, As Serious As Your Life?
Ah, yeah.
I've only just found it recently, but then since finding it, all these people have been talking about it.
Yeah.
It's this classic book. It's like, oh, God.
Very
classic. I wish
Yeah, that was a big one for me. I read that as a teenager, and that was definitely a big part of finding out about this music.
Yeah, and then, I think I've just finished the AACM chapter.
Right.
But just realised, there's so much music there I've not even touched
stuff.
Or even thought about, kind of, it's just vast history, isn't it?
It is. And I think there's sections get a bit missed out. I think the AACM is maybe getting into more musicians' awareness now than even 10 years ago. It takes time, I guess, for everyone to catch up. But sometimes I think everyone knows sort of classic 60s stuff and modern stuff.
Yeah, but that's
there's so much incredible 70s, 80s music pre CD, but after sort of classic 60s Blue Note impulse that doesn't get talked about anything like as much.
Yeah,
and a lot of really astonishing music.
Definitely, even chatting to people about because I recorded the interview with Cory Mwamba yesterday.
Right.
But talking to him about the stuff that he was checking out when he was getting into it, then all these, 90s British jazz albums,
Yeah.
And it was just oh, God, I've no idea, about those records. It's kind of, they sort of got lost along the way.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing in a way about things having changed with the internet and Spotify and stuff like that. That there's the idea that everything is now available, but it's completely not true. A selection of things is available.
Yeah.
And there's a danger of that becoming a more homogenous selection. Because I think, I don't sound like an old man moaning about the world changing,
cool.
But yeah, I think there was a time when people found stuff in charity shops and their aunt's record collection and whatever, and the six things you found early on are a very particular influence on you. And that's a valuable thing, in a way. It's obviously amazing to check everything else out too, but if you sort of go to college and are told these are things you need to hear and those are there and you can listen to them on your computer and there's the sort of certified body of important work, everyone hears the same stuff. And that can be a very homogenising influence.
Definitely, yeah. But I don't know how to feel about a lot of that internet stuff. Because yeah, I guess it's like incredible. Everything's available.
Yeah.
But yeah, like similar thing to what you're saying, like for me anyway, like yeah, like checking out music, like you had to order it.
Yeah.
From the album,
there is a value
shop,
to having to put the work in a way.
Yeah, and like listening to the first listen, you'd be like, "Am I sure about this?" And then you grow to love it. But then, it's like that kind of process of internalizing it.
Yeah.
But then, I don't know. But it's hard to draw parallels with how teenagers are in society now. They probably develop information way different ways.
For sure. Yeah, and everything, you know. Everyone who's going to get curious, check stuff out, finds their own way of doing that. There's no point thinking, oh, things are different in why I don't get off my lawn sort of thing. But I do think the relevant point there is I think there's a lot of stuff which still isn't readily available. It still needs to be sought out, and some of which is really amazing and is an important part of the story of the development of that music. That, like, if, for example, people are excited by where Evan Parker's up to now and know Topography of the Lungs and the really early SME stuff, all of which is incredible, that's great, but to understand that process you need to hear the 70s and 80s stuff, and there's some really intense, some of the maddest improv period I think was the late 70s, like the early duo of Evan with Paul Litton, the name which has gone up my head, but it's more extreme than pretty much anything else he ever did. It's just so experimental, literally, that actually just trying stuff out in very unrefined language in a way, but really exciting for it. Or some of Steve Lacy's most full-on stuff, like the duo with Derek Bailey and Steve Lacy. Again, the name's gone out of my head. There's two albums. The first one in particular is just incredible. I think there are, bits of history get much more readily told than other bits.
Definitely, especially thinking about Steve Lacy as an example. Everyone just thinks of him as like, oh yeah, he's the guy who's really into Monk and played soprano saxophone, but then there's like so much more.
Totally, and the Monk stuff is phenomenal and amazing too, but yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of different things to check out, basically.
The man, it's kind of scary, isn't it? But I know AACM stuff is on the list. Let's check out, especially that Threadgill kind of things.
But
they're still going today, AACM, aren't they?
I don't know much about what they do as an organisation, but they definitely still exist. But certainly a lot of the giants of that scene are still alive and doing amazing work. Like Roscoe Mitchell, just every time I see him or hear his new albums, they blow me away. They're all consistently incredible. Woodard Leo Smith as well. And they are now really getting their due at last, like winning big prizes and getting a lot of influence. But
totally.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Definitely. And then, but just thinking now, trying to think if there's anything else we've missed. Before
sure
I went on off
lots.
On one Chicago-based musician. Actually, you spent some time in Chicago, New York, didn't you?
Yeah, briefly. Not very long, but... I was lucky enough, my partner was doing a PhD at the time and had some funding to go and do some research there, and I tagged along basically, and got hung out in Chicago for a few weeks, and then I've been to New York a couple of times too. Yeah, it's a great city, though I didn't really find much of the AACM scene. It was
Vandermark and
I'd toured with Ken here before I went, so
Again,
that was a Poland connection originally. I first played in Poland, and we did a little trio tour with Mark Sanders over here.
Wow.
And then played with him in Chicago twice on different trips. Yeah.
Oh, great. Then, but I guess, is that a different feeling playing with those guys over there than it is the guys based here? In terms of where they go musically, or?
I wouldn't draw any generalisation about it. I mean, each individual person's obviously different to play with. I wouldn't describe it that way, I don't think.
Yeah,
I mean, it's amazing, Ken. It's a joy to play with for sure.
I guess the place I was coming from, or maybe kind of in the earlier history of the music, where there was definitely like free jazz improviser kind of thing in America.
Yeah.
Than the European improvising scene.
Yes.
Because I guess they've kind of got different distinctions, haven't they?
Yeah, for sure.
But I guess everything's. influencing each other now, aren't they?
Yeah, and all, there's always been a lot of going back and forth as well. As I'm for sure people over here were trying to find their own voice, but they were also at Trevor Watts playing with Bobby Radford a lot. And
oh, well, did he? Always, wow.
Yeah, there's a fantastic quartet record, and they did a few things together. There's always been both, I think, separate but also interplay.
Yeah.
It is amazing. I do feel like it's an incredible privilege of being involved in that music here, that we can actually play with inventors of
exactly. Genre, it's amazing, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
and just thinking, yeah, because was it because they were involved in, was it the Spontaneous Music Ensemble?
Yeah, exactly.
So Trevor Watts, Evan Parker, and
well, any before of those guys Evan, originally it was John Stevens, Trevor Watts, and Paul Rutherford.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
At the beginning, then Evan and Derek Bailey got involved. Kenny Wheeler was involved. Dave Holland, Jeff Klein.
Wow.
Different people, but that original trio of John Stevens, Paul Radford and Trevor Watts, that's like really the beginning of improvised music in this country. I moved to London. I think the first improv gig I went to after moving back to London was Paul Rutherford's memorial, so he'd just passed away, and I'd never actually saw him live. But the others, like, you know, I get to play joys with Trevor Watts. It's amazing, because you were like, relative to the history of our music, that's like getting to play joys with Louis Armstrong or something.
it's
incredible.
Definitely. But I think I've got a clip of that on my phone, because when we did that double bill, I remember I took a little video of you guys playing. Yeah, maybe I'll put it in the intro, I don't know. Yeah, or the outro, who knows. But dude, thanks so much for doing the podcast, man.
Thanks
and
for inviting me.
Traveling
it's
up here.
Very
yeah.
fun.
Thank you.
There we go. That was Ollie Bryce. Thanks for listening, and yeah, hopefully see you next time. Bye.